Welcome to Place Matters, a podcast about the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to the next installment of our series on FCS's three pillars. This series will focus on the pillar of mixed income housing. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS and the host for Place Matters. In the midst of rapidly gentrifying cities, people often ask us what can be done to stem the tide of rising costs and the displacement of legacy residents. As welcomed as more retail, nicer parks, and better infrastructure are for neighborhoods that have been historically denied these basic things, they are often evidence that longer-term, lower-income residents will soon be pushed out, and all this new development wasn't done with them in mind anyway. So what do? Some will advocate for better policies, and we agree. Some will say that we've got to lobby for more affordable housing, and we also agree. For us, however, the best neighborhood-level solution is a robust acquisitions strategy. Joining me today to talk about our acquisitions process are FCS President Jim Wehner, our Senior Director of Community Development Marvin Nesbitt, and our Director of Mixed Income Housing Cynthia McNeil. So in historic South Atlanta alone, we've been involved in around 300 different units of housing. But backing up, how do we go about that? So do we just start acquiring whatever we can afford, whenever we can afford it, whatever comes up available? Or is there some other kind of way to say, here's our strategic approach to what we acquire when? Is it just about the dollars, or is there something else that informs a strategy for getting into housing in a neighborhood?
It's both and. Okay. So there's definitely a strategy to what we do. And as we look at neighborhoods, so we map the neighborhood. Okay. So we keep fairly detailed maps of what's happening in the neighborhood and can often tell fairly quickly what construction's happening in the neighborhood, that kind of thing. So there's some strategy, like what areas of the neighborhood aren't covered or what types of house are needed on blocks, that kind of thing. And then from a funding strategy, I would tell you that we've gone to school with our for-profit friends and partners. We understand that somewhere around 2008, that those who were able to be effective in acquiring properties had capital to do so. And that as a nonprofit, we didn't. And we were left on the sidelines in 2008 and 2009 because we didn't have a pool of capital. You couldn't borrow. The bank, you know, we were in a sort of generational recession at that point and or crisis and economically, and you couldn't borrow. And so we were stuck watching investors buy in the neighborhood, and we recognized if we're going to build a program that can compete in the market, we had to be able to have a source of capital where we could buy a property, pay cash for it, close in 2 weeks without contingencies. And because that's what the market does, that's who all our competitors, that's how they're working. And so in 2010 and 11, we raised that bit of capital so that we could move that way. We adjusted our team structure, Cynthia's team that does a lot of that. We adjusted that team to be able to acquire quickly and then hold. So it's very strategic, but I would say even now, in terms of acquisition strategy, we're looking pre-market. So we're trying to be aware of what might be coming to market. If we can acquire before it goes to market, you can get it. You can keep your costs in control sometimes. And so that's what's happening. If you're in a neighborhood right now where you're getting pummeled by investors, you know, are you interested in selling your property? That's what they're doing. They're trying to get it pre-market. So, so we pay attention to how the, I don't want to say competitors because we need for-profit development. A neighborhood was devoid of that prior to 2017, 2018. And now it's just a massive amount of competition, but, but so there is a financial reality and that we've put together a capital pool to be able to do that. And we've diversified that capital pool so that we've got rental capital to buy rent, potential rentals and for sale capital to buy houses that we're going to sell for home ownership. So fairly, fairly nuanced. Most real estate organizations are, and we just have realized if we want to create affordable housing, you just, there's really no way to compete in the market that's moving so quickly. And so we've tried to design a real estate team that can be flexible, that can, I don't want to say that is risk averse. We are very aware of risk, like in housing, any sort of real estate, it's a risky game, right? You can lose a lot of money on a property that you thought was going to be great. So we try to not get in love with any single unit or parcel, but we try to manage just like a real estate company would be, with the exception of there's often where when we have a parcel that we're trying to acquire, we run it through a sort of a little financial calculator, and the margins are always thin, and there's always subsidy that controls affordability, and that subsidy is growing, not increasing, but we run it through that little matrix we have, and if it doesn't work, we'll walk away and go to the next parcel. So it's strategic, and there is capital that we've had to raise. I don't know, what would you add, Cynthia?
Probably part of the acquisition strategy is we're no different than any other developer and investor when we're looking at properties. So we're looking at properties on the market, off market. We're looking at, you know, partners that we have or other builders that, you know, been in the neighborhood that's aware of a property that's coming that they, you know, have probably walked away from and to see if that's actually a part of our neighborhood or our footprint. For the most part, you know, I'm either looking at properties on, you know, online, on the MLS, along with other agents. Sometimes we get referrals from individuals that know about the work that we do. They kind of keep an eye on prospects that come about, some, you know, properties that they're aware of. And so we're very strategic about which particular areas we're working in. So the four neighborhoods that we're currently working in, we're just always prospecting in those neighborhoods. We look at the price first to see if it's something that we can afford to buy. Also, when I go in, I'm looking at the properties. So we go out, we do an assessment of those particular properties to kind of see what damages there are, what type of constructions that's needed so we can put together a budget to see if we actually have enough funds to cover the cost of those projects. The other thing that I'm pretty much have a conscience of is that we try not to purchase or, you know, acquire any properties that already have tenants or residents that's living there. So the objective is not to displace any families or individuals that's already in current properties or that are up for sale. We compete with other investors in the neighborhood because sometimes they're unloading their properties. And so there's sometimes up to eight people in a home and they're wanting to sell it for a good price, which sometimes, well, that's what we're looking for. But at the end of the day, when you have eight individuals that you're going to be displacing because you can't keep them in the, you know, in the situation that they're currently in, because the property that we're going to be buying needs a lot of work. It hasn't been touched in multiple years. And so we just are very conscious about displacing families and individuals on a part of that particular strategy. But we also want to know if the property that we're going to acquire is going to change the block in a healthy way to change, you know, the appearance, if there is blight and vacancy on that particular block, you know, when we're going in. But, you know, costs of acquisition, it matters. We lead with that first and then also the intentionality of what we're going to do with the project. And we try not to leave that property vacant for longer than 6 months at a time if we can help it. And then we move forward with acquiring the property. Then we pull permits. We do pre-construction, you know, pre-development of that particular project, whether it needs to be demoed or renovated. We go to work immediately while it's under contract. We're pulling, getting surveys and things like that and researching the property so we'll know what we are going to be investing in overall project to the end. So
it's certainly hard to get properties, certainly hard to get the money for properties. But let's say properties are available and we have money. How do you develop How do you develop a strategy of which ones to get?
We use the Lilly Fund.
How do we know? Like if there's, you know, 40 houses available, we can do five. You know, we've got the team, the money to run it. Like how do we know what to acquire and when?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been with FCS not too long now. Mm-hmm. We don't turn down
much. He says with foreboding. Jim will buy anything.
He does signs around town. Jim buys ugly houses.
It's Cynthia that does the buying. Jim just gets it in the queue. Yeah.
We don't turn down much. Mm-hmm. I think if all of the financing is there for us to make a move on a particular parcel, we're not afraid to do so. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason being is because if we don't do it, somebody else will.
And they're not thinking about the neighborhood.
Yeah. So I think the more that we can control in the neighborhood, the better our chances of being able to control affordability for a long time. So we're always out prospecting and very intentional about it and about what, you know, seeing what's available and what we can actually bring into our portfolio.
Yeah, and South Atlanta might be different than some in the sense that we've had a intentional housing developer working here for 20 years already. So I think about, we have a client in Florida who's worked with them to map their neighborhood. We've helped them develop a pro forma for acquisition. So they get a realistic sense, if we want to do three houses a year for the next 9 years, here's what it's going to take to do it. What are the factors that we're using to help inform them on what to acquire and how to go about not just haphazardly grabbing whatever they can afford, but they've got a budget, but it's limited. What questions or factors do we use to develop a strategy of which to acquire and in what order?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing, and Jim and Cynthia chime in, but that question of like what can we do on the property, right? Because the last thing you want is that you have a property in your portfolio that's just sitting for years because, you know, it's a difficult lot, or you know, it's tough to build on, or it's going to require you to build something that you're not going to be able to sell affordably. So you end up having this property sitting in your portfolio for years.
Right? Not that we've ever done that.
Not that we would do that, but yeah.
I was trying to keep a straight face.
How do you end up in rentals?
So I think that's probably one of the first the first thoughts. Okay. It's like, can we, as Cynthia said, can we start work on this parcel within 6 months?
Yeah. Okay.
I think sort of higher level on that, the things that I think about, like especially, you know, when we talk about helping a neighborhood developer in Florida that we're working with. I think about questions of what's the market cost right now to acquire a vacant lot or what we'd call an improved lot, which means it has a house on it. So there's a little bit of what's the actual cost that it's going to take us to acquire? What are the rehab costs? Mm-hmm. So do we have a system in place for calculating this is what it's going to cost us? So then you sort of end up with those two. You've got staffing that goes in there. Who's going to do the acquisition piece and how much is that going to cost you? And And so we're thinking about how do we put together a program or a system that allows us to do those three houses per year. Included with that then is the map where we're looking at the neighborhood and seeing if there's a concentration of vacant properties. Okay. Are there a concentration of properties that are really healthy spaces, and can we build off that? Mm-hmm. So take that space and go out, you know, 4 or 5 blocks either way, and can we take what is a healthy spot in the neighborhood and build out from it, so that we're increasing health across the neighborhood, and so that you can legitimately be saying, okay, if we're going to do 3 houses a year for, you know, the next 10 years, that's 30 properties. So what's it take to acquire 30 properties? And how many do we need at a time to do 3 houses a year? And you're sort of looking at it in that mode, and then combining that with the map to say, okay, we're going to concentrate our acquisition in these areas, especially when I think we used to, in South Atlanta, we used to use the term defensible spaces. I'm not sure we would use that same term anymore because we don't want to describe the neighborhood using negative terms, right? We want to think about it in positive light. And so with that, we used to use the term defensible space as this is an area where we had little vacancy and good energy in terms of neighbors, and we want to build out from that. So anyway, when I think about that, there was a time in South Atlanta where we had 3 spaces that we were building out from, and now we've sort of built out so that there's not a block on the neighborhood that we don't have housing on.
So you'd say it's more important to acquire and build from where health exists versus like there's lots of blocks of blight and we're gonna scatter houses. So there's at least a house on this block. There's at least a house on that block. You'd say actually wherever there's momentum and health, actually add to that and let it grow out rather than scattering your development to disrupt blight. Is that accurate?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. And I think when we think about what it takes to build neighborhood, right? You want people to be in that experiencing that place of health. I think connecting to those spaces and building out from it to me makes good strategic sense. That doesn't mean you won't be opportunistic, and if you have chances to get properties in maybe spaces that aren't as healthy, you do it. If it makes sense and you have the
because somebody eventually
the resources
will,
yeah, be better to, for
yeah,
sure
yeah yeah.
And I would probably say, just to piggyback off of Jim and Marvin, is outside of the acquisition part of that, having funds to acquire the property, looking at the assessment of what, you know, construction costs, renovation costs is, you need to have a family ready for that complete or finished home that you're getting ready to either put on the market or either have it rented out. That's one of the things that we're not necessarily having difficulty with, but in our affordable side of after acquisitions and completion of construction, is difficult to find families that can actually afford the construction of the home that we're getting ready to put on the market, you know. And that's going to require someone having, within the affordable side, it requires someone to have some type of homeownership or home buying counseling and training to get them prepared and ready for a home. So if you're looking at your partners who are going to be either financing it in-house and producing homes and trying to find families to serve a certain population, that population that you're probably going to be working with is 9 times out of 10, 50% or more of them can't afford a home at $300,000 or even at $200,000 and $250,000 at this point. So they need training and counseling to get them prepared for that. So,
and of course, you know, we've talked about previously about how important the strategy of mixed income housing is versus just all affordable. So when you're beginning in a neighborhood, do you begin with mixed income or do you begin, I think, with FCS, at least whether that was on purpose or not? We started with affordable for a long time before we even started adding workforce bank qualified homes. Is that the way the strategy should be? Was that just by nature of what we were doing? If someone's getting started in a neighborhood, Should they be mixed income from the jump, or should they start in the affordable space and then eventually add mixed income housing? How does that work?
I would probably, well, I know Jim has a response to that, but I would say we don't start with mixed income first. We are actually going into a neighborhood and starting, you know, where that neighborhood currently is. Mm-hmm. And most of the neighborhoods, or all the neighborhoods that we worked in, we're already serving individuals who would be looking at affordable housing. And so we're just building blocks from there to kind of like get to a place of having mixed income housing. It's not until probably what, maybe 10, 15 years ago that we decided that just all one class of housing is in a block, I mean, in a neighborhood that we're actually building, that we need to have mixed income in that neighborhood so we can bring in resources for that particular neighborhood. So, but.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, go ahead. No, yeah, I was about to say I agree as well. And also just thinking about, you know, one of the things I think this organization does well is allowing or understanding the assets in the neighborhood and allowing the assets that are in the neighborhood help determine kind of where you start, you know, where, you know, what the plan is or informing the plan. And so if you come in and really do your research and study and understand the mapping that Jim talks about.
Do the relational work, building relationships.
Absolutely. You kind of... that helps determine and kind of where you start, right? And doing all that work may tell you start with mixed income. It may not. It may tell you that you start with single family and single family rental, not necessarily single family for sale, right? Just depends on kind of what the assets in the neighborhood look like.
Yeah, and I would probably say our neighbors that we partner with don't want all one price range of house, you know. I don't want to use the term low income, but they don't want, you know, a high percentage of that in their neighborhood. They want to have mixed income because I think I would say historically, from learning over a period of time and working at FCS, I would say majority of neighborhoods that we worked in at some point in time were flourishing neighborhoods. Back then, and then they went through a cycle of economical changes and, you know, adversity. And so we're moving back into that neighborhood and helping to transform that neighborhood to where it is now to bring them up. But a lot of our neighbors or older neighbors that speak into what it is that we do, they don't want all one set, you know, price range of housing. They want a variety to get them back to where they can have you know, higher property values. They, you know, they want to have more, you know, resources and investment into the neighborhood to bring it back to where it used to be. So,
yeah, I was looking at something recently about the concentration of poverty and extremes, and that, I don't know who put it together or why, but they were saying that once a neighborhood gets past 40%, like that's what is considered extreme, right? And so, like, and when they track the disadvantages and the cascading effects of the concentration of poverty in certain places, that's the number. And so when we think about, obviously we're working with historically disinvested neighborhoods, and we are actively working to not displace anyone, to stabilize those who are there. There's this trick, this strategy of saying, like, how do we stabilize, protect, and make sure that those who are here, the low-income, vulnerable families, that we're supporting that, but we're also recognizing if we want infrastructure to improve, businesses to come back, schools to get better, like all the opportunities neighborhoods provide, we've got to mix the incomes. And so there's, and the way we acquire is going to be what determines how that, you know, kind of unfolds over time.
I would say not only that, but because it is by mission that we go into places where there's a high concentration of poverty, that starting on the affordable side first, whether it's affordable rental or even more affordable home ownership, that's one of the ways we push against displacement, because as we bring mixed income, we understand we are doing our work in vacant parcels, meaning we're not displacing anybody. But as you grow a neighborhood socioeconomically, there's that potential for displacement of your lower income family. So if you've done the work of affordable rental and most specifically affordable home ownership, so that those families own their property and they now have the agency of choice on how they want to respond to a neighborhood that's changing. And they get the benefit of having an asset that is growing in value. Mm. That, I would say, from in all of our housing work, is what I'm most passionate about, is the provision of affordable home ownership to families that can own a home but don't qualify in our system of banking right now, because our system, the way our system looks at risk, considers these, but these families have rented from us for years, and we know they can pay a mortgage. The mortgage has to be rightly sized, and they can own a property and be building wealth now. And so for me, when I answer that question for FCS, I want to say affordable home ownership. We have to be thoughtful, and we have to continue to push against the system that makes that type of home ownership difficult. But if we lead with that, we're putting folks, or bringing folks back into the neighborhood that can now own and be in place and have agency. Same thing for the affordable rentals. Because we can hold them affordably, it allows people to stay as neighborhood is changing. And just to be clear, these neighborhoods are going to change because the market's going to move. The market moves in a way that it's happening, whether FCS or another community quarterback is in the neighborhood or not. And so I think in our work of housing, when we prioritize what we're going in to do, prioritize that affordable rental and that affordable home ownership, and some workforce home ownership, that that allows us to ensure that that folks that live in the neighborhood are able to stay as the neighborhood is transforming.
I would think that after 20 plus years here and over 40 years as a whole, that what we've observed is that lower income individual families aren't higher risk. They just are lower profit for a bank. Right. That when we look at our rates of, you know, whether it be foreclosure or eviction or missed payments, like lower income families are doing just as good or better than market averages. But banks can say, well, that, that person or family is higher risk. But the truth is what we found is they're not. They're not higher risk. They're just lower profit. And so we've got to kind of create an alternative economy to work with families to say, actually, you're worth this. Like you are able and capable to meet the demands of this, but banks want bigger mortgages that these families couldn't take on.
I think it goes back to a prior conversation we were having about, I think we do a good job of focusing on helping families get into their sweet spot so that they can be successful, right? Versus holding them to these standards that traditional banks may hold them to, that also creates distress for the family, right? Trying to figure out how they're going to make those mortgages and operate at those interest rates, right? That a traditional bank would offer them. Again, we are helping them get into that comfort zone and their sweet spot, to where we know that if right in their sweet spot, there's a great chance for them to be successful. And we've been able to, that's been demonstrated over a number of years of data that FCS has. That, you know, we have families that are not, we're not foreclosing on, or not always behind in mortgage payments and rents. They're performing very well. So, and we're not, and that may be because we're not a profit-driven organization. So we're able to really do that because we are really committed to the mission, as Jim stated. So,
so take us, go ahead.
I would just kind of like follow up on that. I would say we don't disagree with standards, you know, that, you know, income being in compliance with banking and lending. But at FCS, we create options for those individuals that may go up against those particular, you know, adversities that they face when they go out to get private lending. So we are trying to form partnerships with lenders that are actually helping us create options of down payment assistance, helping individuals that may qualify, you know, that don't have your traditional credit score of 620. Mm-hmm. You have individuals that we may have options for that qualify for that has a credit score of 520, you know, 560, which is a little bit lower than what your traditional bank mm-hmm. would actually be interested in, you know, investing in someone to even, you know, borrow mm-hmm. money. They're still making a profit, but mm-hmm. they just won't take the opportunity to look at that individual. So we, you know, we do create options for mm-hmm. Individuals. So
well said.
To buy a home.
Yeah.
Really well
yeah,
said.
That's good. So I know there's three of you plus one of our board members who functions as a consultant with this. There's a lot of energy that goes into the acquisitions work. So take us into the war room a little bit, and like week in, week out, what does it take for us to have the infrastructure to pull off acquisitions on a regular basis?
Well, I'm working week in and week out on my acquisitions.
8 days a week. That's a different song.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Now, we have a housing planning meeting every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And in that room includes the three of us. Mm-hmm. It includes our project manager for construction. Mm-hmm. And it includes Danielle, who listeners will have heard on other pieces of the podcast. She's our director of finance and HR. And and it includes one of our board members mm-hmm. that we actually hire as his firm as a consulting group to help us with acquisition.
The bulldog.
Yeah, for sure. Right.
And why is it? Why do we need a bulldog?
Because he goes after the most difficult properties, and he mm-hmm. actually is from the outside looking in. We mm-hmm. go in. I don't want to use it that way, but we go in with a heart whenever we're talking to someone about acquiring their property. He doesn't look at it that way. He's a little bit more assertive, a little yeah. more aggressive. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to say less intentional, but he's just like, I want to buy your property. Mm-hmm. You know, what can you sell it to me for? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he has a little bit more, grit.
Yeah.
Behind him yeah. when it comes yeah. to approaching someone with an off-market property. Mm-hmm. So we like to work with John on that.
Yeah.
So he's been very beneficial That's to awesome. Us in that way. So
yeah, he's also able to, you know, he puts us in a more of a proactive posture.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. When it comes to being able to compete mm-hmm. with the private sector mm-hmm. Developers And so, you know, and that's, he has years of experience, mm-hmm. right? And I've never, you know, I haven't seen many minds that work the yep. way his mind works.
Yeah.
You know, he can rattle off proformas and evaluations in a matter of minutes in wow. his head, whereas it would take me all sorts of days and hours to yep. research before I can get back. To a good decision on yeah. whether or not this is a viable mm-hmm. Purchase or mm-hmm. not. So
yeah.
I think I think for us, you know, we need that mm-hmm. if we're going to really mm-hmm. be able to purchase, you know, at mm-hmm. the rate mm-hmm. that we desire, and also compete.
Yeah.
You know, also,
we have to hold the purse strings for him because he always goes in highest and best.
Well, bulldogs sometimes need a leash, you know. There's both, yeah, right? You know? That's
right. And a choke chain.
Yeah. yeah.
That's for you, John. And so, no, I would say the other thing he does, because he's a real estate professional, he helps us get out of our sort of nonprofit minds sometimes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He looks at... He looks at property assemblage for our commercial side, mm-hmm. our economic development side. Mm-hmm. So part of the economic development work we're doing, and it mm-hmm. requires getting control of property.
Mm-hmm.
And he's at the front edge of a lot of that for mm-hmm. us, often seeing value in, oh, if we could assemble these three properties, mm-hmm. we could do this. Mm-hmm. And the three of us will be like, oh, yeah, we hadn't really thought about that
yeah.
because he's a real estate professional. Yeah. He sees things that we just may not,
yeah.
and he helps us stretch to mm-hmm. To acquire properties
yeah.
well. And so there's that. I don't want to mm-hmm. call it a machine, but there's that group mm-hmm. that we meet every 2 weeks, and we actually are not only looking at what we're acquiring. We do have a list of mm-hmm. properties that we would call incoming.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. we look at every property that we have in construction and pre-construction, which right now is about 25 properties that we're managing along the construction continuum. So we're talking for 2 hours every 2 weeks, just are there moving properties around? This one has a slowdown on it. We need to move it back. And here we can move another one forward and concentrate on that. So yeah, there's a lot of, a lot of work that goes in with that group. I want to say on the off week or in the times when we're not in that meeting, just preparing for that meeting in terms of, oh, we know we're going to talk about this property or that property. So that's one thing we do. There's obviously others.
We're actually, you know, discussing where we are with cost, any roadblocks or anything like that. You know, what's the holdup that we may be facing, you know, to get the project completed by the end. And then thinking about where we are with the next, you know, 5 to 10 properties that's coming in, and what are going to be any, you know, delays with construction, how we get through, you know, permitting processes with the city, you know, making relationships with other builders, making relationships with the city to continue the construction process that we're working on. So,
So The Color of Law by Rothstein has been an important book for our organization. Just looking at the history of that, the shape of our neighborhoods was on purpose. Like, we didn't get here by accident, right? The federal government, law enforcement, banking industry, local associations, neighborhood covenants, like all of these things were aggressively working together to shape our cities the way that we are now living into them. And he and his daughter wrote a follow-up to that called Just Action. And a theme throughout of it is like, the level of strategy and aggression that it took to create these systems, we're not going to undo them unless we at least match that level of strategy and aggression, if not outpace it. And that just like protesting or marching or believing or voting, all these things are good and necessary. But like, change is not going to come from a Black Lives Matter sign on your yard, which that's important. But change is going to come when people get together and say, we're going to bulldog. Like, if we have got to aggressively change the structure of our neighborhoods, and we can't do this by accident or just by goodwill or by a couple of donations. Like, it takes day in and day out aggressive strategic monitoring. And we've got to, and King said, those who, you know, or we have to organize for love as much as we organize for war, or we're not going to see it, right? And so this level of detailed strategy to me is what makes this, what makes it brilliant, what makes it work.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't always think about us as aggressive, like with that term. But I do think about us as energetic and committed and determined, you know, that what's become a popular saying now, but we've had in the picture up in our office for years that says we can do hard things, and our housing team continually just works at hard things. And so that determination to say it can be different here, and we can have that determination while we're also being kind and generous and responsible and accountable. Like, those things can all go together. And so that's definitely one thing that I would say about our housing team is the amount of determination in the face of just overarching systemic struggles to get a property built and a house produced for a family, and then the family in it and the family flourishing. All of that work that it takes, our housing team stays pretty determined all the time.
And there's so much bad news and there's so much rational reason for despair, right, with the things that we see going on. And I think what I see out of this housing team is, like, equity is possible. Change is possible. Closing the wealth gap is possible. It can be done, and we're doing it. And so I just want to thank you guys and your teams for your Herculean efforts to make this possible. You guys are quite amazing, so thank you. And thanks for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
The best way to learn about our housing work and everything else we do is to come and see it for yourself. We love hosting guests in our neighborhood and at FCS. Coming March of 2024, we will be hosting a two-day immersive event that we simply call Open House. Come, meet our team, see the work, and walk the neighborhood. To register, go to fcsministries.org/openhouse. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you'd like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in your show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the video can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you did like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rose with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park and Becca Klein at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. And we would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment Incorporated, whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.